The headlines: Palestinians hail as a victory the UN resolution that calls for the World Court's opinion on Israel's occupation of their land. Japan and South Korea say the North has fired several missiles toward the sea east of the Korean Peninsula. And also coming up, Venezuela's opposition votes to dissolve the so-called interim government led by Juan Guaido. Thank you for joining us. Our top story: the UN General Assembly has adopted a resolution calling on the International Court of Justice to give its opinion on Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. The resolution seeks an advisory opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation, settlement, and annexation of Palestinian territories. It also seeks opinion on Israeli measures aimed at changing the demographic composition and status of the holy city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The US, Canada, Germany, and Britain were among Western states that voted against the UN resolution. Russia and China voted in favor. The Palestinian ambassador to the UN has hailed the countries backing the resolution for standing up against Israel.
This vote and request comes one day after the new Israeli government was formed, pledging to accelerate colonial and racist policies against the Palestinian people. We trust that regardless of your vote today, if you believe in international law and peace, you will uphold the opinion of the International Court of Justice when delivered, and you will stand up to this Israeli government right now, because freedom, justice, and peace shall prevail.
Other Palestinian Authority figures also lauded the UN resolution. The spokesman for President Mahmoud Abbas said it's time the Israeli regime is held accountable for its crimes against Palestinians. Another top official said the UN vote reflects the victory of Palestinian diplomacy. The World Court last weighed in on the Palestinian dispute in 2004 when it ruled that an Israeli separation barrier was illegal. Israel rejected that ruling, saying the verdict was politically motivated. Meanwhile, Israeli forces conduct a fresh raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, injuring dozens of Palestinians. The troops used live ammunition, rubber bullets, and tear gas against the Palestinians. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more details about the raids.
Well, the Israeli forces have raided Nablus city early on Friday. According to the Israeli military, the main aim of the operation was to arrest a Palestinian who is a member, as you have mentioned, of the Lion's Den group, Ahmed al-Masri. After, few hours of clashes that took place between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces who raided the city of Nablus, unfortunately, at the end of the day, Ahmed al-Masri, 19-year-old Palestinian, was shot and wounded, and he was arrested by the Israeli troops. 35 Palestinians were also wounded during the operation that took place in Nablus early on Friday. After the Friday prayers, Palestinians were taking part in anti-Israeli settlement protests in the village of Osirin, as you have also said. And as usual, this continues to anger the Israeli military and the Israeli settlers, because at the end of the day, the Israelis don't want for the Palestinians to continue taking part in the different forms of resistance, even if it was a popular resistance. Clashes took place, and at least a dozen of the Palestinians were wounded during the clashes that took place in Osirin.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has slammed as delusional the Israeli prime minister's claims against the Islamic Republic. Nasser Kanani says Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to forge an identity for himself and the illegitimate Israeli regime. Kanani says the Israeli regime has for 70 years been suffering from an identity crisis accompanied by genocide, looting, forced displacement, and many other human rights violations. He said these atrocities are the result of wrong policies by the US, UK, and some other European countries in supporting the regime. Kanani stressed that Palestine is indestructible while the Israeli regime is doomed to decline. Netanyahu was sworn in as Israeli Prime Minister on Thursday in a comeback as the head of a hard right cabinet. In his address to Parliament, he accused Iran of seeking to develop a nuclear bomb, an allegation Tehran has repeatedly denied, and an allegation that Netanyahu has made for several decades now. North Korea has reportedly fired three missiles toward the sea east of the Korean Peninsula. The South Korean and the Japanese military say the projectiles were ballistic missiles. The development is a further escalation to the ongoing tensions in the region. North Korea has test-fired a record blitz of missiles over the past months. The North claims the tests are in response to the United States' growing presence in the region and its joint military drills with South Korea and Japan. Pyongyang says the exercises are provocative and rehearsals for an invasion. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, explains why tensions on the Korean Peninsula continue to escalate unabated.
Just Thursday, 2 days ago, South Korea conducted a large-scale drill aimed at shooting down North Korean drones, and it has also passed a budget to increase spending on jamming and other technologies that would boost South Korea's air defense capabilities against North Korean drones. So now this arms race has no end in sight, and many experts say that with the escalations in tensions, we will see even more missile tests by North Korea in the near future than we have been seeing in recent months. Of course, this year, North Korea fired over 90 ballistic and cruise missiles, and today's test was the 37th day this year that it has fired missiles. So this is really causing a tremendous amount of tension. The South Korea-U.S. military drills and the North Korean tests and provocations in response to those drills. With neither side backing down or willing to compromise, there is a real danger that tensions will escalate accidentally out of control.
Turning elsewhere now, Venezuela's opposition groups have voted to disband their so-called interim government led by Juan Guaido and backed by the United States. Three of four major opposition groups backed removing Guaido during the Friday voting. They've said in a joint statement that the so-called interim government is no longer useful. Guaido has denounced the vote as a jump into vacuum. The vote is a blow to the U.S. as well. That's because Washington backed Guaido when he declared himself president of Venezuela almost 4 years ago. The U.S. also tried to rally international support for Guaido. He declared himself president following elections that saw incumbent Nicolas Maduro get re-elected. Guaido had blamed Maduro's government for the economic problems of Venezuela. Caracas blames them on U.S. sanctions. Staying in the region where anger is flaring up in Bolivia over the arrest of Luis Fernando Camacho, a regional governor and right-wing opposition leader, protests in the commercial hub of Santa Cruz have once again turned violent, with some people attacking buildings, torching cars, and blocking highways. Police resorted to tear gas to disperse the crowd that was demanding the release of Camacho. The opposition figure was detained Wednesday on charges of terrorism. He is also accused of being involved in Bolivia's 2019 unrest that saw then-President Evo Morales resign. Camacho is now in a maximum security prison in the capital, La Paz. He has been sentenced to 4 months of pre-trial detention. Camacho has denied any wrongdoing. Rallies have also taken place demanding him to be brought to justice. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's tax returns have been released, ending a controversial six-year battle. A Democratic-controlled House committee released thousands of pages of redacted documents, which shed a new light on how the former president handled his finances. The returns span from 2015 through 2020, covering Trump's candidacy and White House tenure. The documents reveal that Trump paid very little federal income taxes and, in some instances, didn't pay taxes at all. The committee also found that the Internal Revenue Service had broken its own rules by not auditing Trump for 3 of the 4 years he was president. Trump played down the release of his returns, saying little new information had actually been unveiled regarding his tax practices. Trump faces several legal challenges as he mounts a 2024 presidential re-election bid. We were earlier joined by Emeritus Professor of California State University, Paul Sheldon Foote, with his take on Trump's tax returns. So let's take a listen to that.
What it tells you is about the stupidity of Democrats and people who believe what they disclosed. I have not read anything yet in the articles about this saying that anything he did was illegal. We have real estate clubs here in California where individuals, I could be doing it, anyone could be doing it, where we could invest in an apartment, a condo, and get deductions for it, and we could have positive cash flow. Those laws have been around longer than I can remember, where they were put in to encourage real estate development. If you want to take that away from the American people and have less development, you go ahead and do it. The Democrats also made a big deal about disclosures that he had financial ties with communist China. Really? What are they? Why not disclose the ties of Hunter Biden with China and Ukraine?
Turning elsewhere now, Russia shells several Ukrainian towns across a long stretch of the eastern front line a day after it carried out another series of strikes against Ukraine's critical infrastructure. In the capital, Kiev, sirens were heard after several explosions rocked the city on Friday. To the south, Russian forces fired on several towns and villages, including Bakhmut and the nearby areas. That's where the Russian military is pushing a campaign to take the entire Donetsk region from Ukraine. On Thursday, Russia also launched what it called a massive strike on energy and military targets. Moscow says the attacks are aimed at disrupting Ukraine's ability to repair equipment and move troops. Kiev, however, accuses Russia of hitting civilian targets. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's relations with the EU have reached their lowest point, warning that it's not business as usual with the bloc. Russia says the EU's policies only hurt the well-being of its own citizens, and Moscow has accused the West of prolonging the war in Ukraine by providing weapons to Kiev.
Oil relations between Russia and the EU has reached its lowest point. That's according to the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The top Russian diplomat says Moscow will not do business as usual with the EU, warning that it would find countries to work with beyond Europe. Lavrov further accused the EU of declaring, quote, a hybrid war in Moscow by unquestioningly following the U.S. He said Brussels policies have only hurt the interests and well-being of EU citizens themselves. Lavrov has also accused the U.S. of barring EU nations from conducting dialogue on energy with Moscow. This despite the fact that Russia's supplies of cheap gas to Europe has provided the continent with, quote, unprecedented prosperity for decades. Naturally, there will be no more business as usual with such counterparties. We do not intend either to knock on closed doors or initiate any joint projects. The world is not just the European Union for us, and we have lots of friends and like-minded nations elsewhere, is what the Russian foreign minister said. The war between Russia and Ukraine started back in February. Since then, the West, spearheaded by the U.S., have imposed waves of unprecedented economic sanctions on Moscow while supplying large consignments of heavy weaponry to Kiev. The Kremlin has said that the sanctions and the Western military assistance will prolong the war.
Well, last year it was $2.3 billion, and from financial year 2023, we'll put in another $2.3 billion. Some of that is non-military aid. Some of that is, you know, the likes of humanitarian support, such as generators. Some of that is obviously military hardware. Some of it is training. Some of it is effectively backfilling British stocks. So stocks we've given away, we need to replace to make sure our armed forces are up to date and on the forefront of being able to defend ourselves. So that's what makes up the $2.3 billion. We're committed to another $2.3 billion for 2023.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Special live coverage for the start of New Year 2023 on Saturday, December 31st at 7:30 p.m. Tehran time, 1600 GMT.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If you strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary. The divine traditions are laws. How do laws work? The law is about a certain situation and it has a decree or a result. God satisfied our needs. The divine traditions are of different kinds and types. In one place he says, if you are grateful, I will certainly give more to you. In another he says, and if you are ungrateful, my chastisement is truly severe. This is chapter 14, verse 7. If we put up ourselves in that situation, being ungrateful, that result will come upon us. So both of these results are based on divine tradition, and it can work either way. Well, there are two cases referred to in chapter Ali Imran. It is strange that these two cases are both referred to in one chapter and are related to one event. Of course, there are two cases, but the two cases are related to one another. Two kinds of traditions are referred to: the tradition of victory and the tradition of defeat. One is in verses 173 of chapter Ali Imran. Those to whom the people said, "Surely men have gathered against you, therefore fear them." But this increased their faith, and they said, "Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee." So they returned with favor from Allah. This is chapter 3, verses 173 to 174.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You have probably heard his story. The Battle of Uhud had finished. Someone like Hamza, Sayyid al-Shahada, had been martyred in this battle. The Prophet had been wounded. The commander of the faithful had been wounded. Many people had been martyred, tired, worn out, and wounded. They returned to Medina. The Quraysh, the same enemy who had failed to do anything and strike a blow, but they had not been able to defeat the Muslims. They gathered outside Medina, just a few kilometers away from Medina, and said, "We will attack tonight. They are tired and won't be able to do anything. We will finish them off." The agents went into Medina and started frightening the people. Those to whom the people said, "Surely men have gathered against you, therefore fear them." Chapter 3, verse 173. They came and asked the people, "Do you know what's happening? Have you heard? The enemy has gathered and has prepared an army. They want to put an end to you. They will attack tonight, and they will do this and do that." They, the enemy, were intimidating the people. Those who were the target of this intimidation said, "Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee." They said, "No, we aren't afraid of them. God is with us."
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Despite its shortcomings, the African continent is growing very fast, and along with that growth comes a challenge to meet the increasing demands for energy, a tough issue for a continent that lacks water. Now, to address this challenge, a number of African countries have decided to produce nuclear energy in the next few years, a decision that the majority of the continent's nations will likely follow suit by 2030.
If you combine the Nile with the Congo River, with the Zambezi, with the River Niger in West Africa, I think it's about 300,000. Megawatts or less for the whole of Africa. So if you take a country like the US has got 1.5 million megawatts of electricity. Therefore, strategically speaking, we cannot depend on hydro.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are discussing African countries' quest to develop nuclear energy. Many say acquiring the technology can be quite challenging. Western countries are not very eager to give the know-how to the continent, and turning to other options like Russia has its own geopolitical challenges. On the second part of the program, we'll be discussing the Nigerian government's decision to use local languages and not English as a language of instruction in primary schools. So stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis on today's subjects.
Nuclear technology for Africa. In November, the International Atomic Energy Agency stated that Ghana, Nigeria, and Kenya could start producing nuclear energy in the next few years. The organization adds that the majority of African countries would be able to do the same by 2030.
Many African countries have realized that to maintain sustainable development, they need to have reliable sources of energy. And for many, the answer is nuclear energy.
Let Nigerians even have sufficient information about the prosperity and the productivity, the future within the radioactive, the nuclear environment.
Power affects every other thing in terms of production, in terms of manufacturing, so we need power.
Well, to discuss this, we are joined by Abayomi Azikiwe, editor at Pan-African Newswire. Many thanks to Mr. Azikiwe for accepting our invitation today. Now, development of the peaceful atom will not only help provide energy to Africans, but also contribute to the modernization of healthcare systems, as well as solving social and economic problems. So how important do you think the development of nuclear power is for the industrialization of Africa?
Well, it depends on the level of other forms of energy and their efficiency. There are enormous problems, for example, in the Republic of South Africa with their national power system. And there have been proposals for the adoption of nuclear power. If as long as it is safe and it is reliable, then it could be an option. Although there are other forms of energy such as solar and hydroelectric power as well, but nuclear power should not be ruled out as a supplement for the generation of energy, particularly in countries that are trying to industrialize or who are semi-industrialized like South Africa.
However, acquiring the nuclear power comes with its own challenges. In Egypt, the El Daba nuclear plant is currently under construction by the Russian state corporation Rosatom. Recently, Burundi has also signed a roadmap with Russia for establishing a dialogue in the sphere. But turning to Russia or China, the other leading industrial partner of the continent, can ruffle many feathers in the West. They do not like it. South Africa, for example, has been offered grants by the Western countries to phase out coal energy in favor of renewables, particularly wind and solar. The West is hoping that all the other 54 African nations could follow suit.
Investment plan, which we will be releasing for discussions, provides us with what I would call a blueprint to address these three challenges, recognizing that they are indeed inseparable and must be seen and addressed in totality. It is about addressing the global risks of climate change, which we experience annually, while also ensuring that as we navigate our way through this transition, we create jobs, new jobs, in new sectors that are going to have to accompany our transition as we move forward.
Another option for the continent is to gain the know-how and become self-reliant at all order indeed. Now, creating the necessary nuclear infrastructure and building the first nuclear power plant can take at least 10 to 15 years. Now, do African countries have the capacity to build nuclear power plants?
Yeah, they do, but they'll need investment from outside countries. As far back as 1964, the government in Ghana under Kwame Nkrumah had requested assistance for the development of nuclear energy from the United States. In fact, when Malcolm X visited the country in 1964, he had sent a letter to the U.S. government through Malcolm X requesting some assistance in regard to the development of nuclear power. But as I mentioned earlier, it's going to take foreign investment and foreign technical assistance in order to make this transition.
Nuclear plants also require strong local maintenance capacity and high technical expertise to ensure they run smoothly and without accidents, which requires operators to invest in local training. Have African countries taken enough steps to develop capacity in this field?
I think there are numerous people who have the technical expertise as engineers, as physicists, and as public administrators. The problem is that the national economies still remain underdeveloped, and many of these technicians and scientists and professionals are recruited by Western imperialist countries to work for their corporations and their governments. So there has to be incentives to ensure that these technical personnel remain in Africa and remain focused on development of the continent.
Maintaining sustainable levels of energy is key for any investments. In fact, when investors want to come and invest in any country, what they look for first is how guaranteed reliable supply of electricity is. This investment could be in any sector, in particular, the agriculture and food processing.
Africa faces substantial challenges in ensuring food security and improving nutrition. Now, contrary to popular perceptions, peaceful use of nuclear techniques can enhance food security and improve health in Africa. Now, what needs to be done for Africa to tap into the potential of nuclear technology in improving food sufficiency and in sectors such as health?
Well, in regard to power generation, the sustainability of storing capacity would be essential. Also, indoor industrial, well, actually light industrial agricultural production of crops would also be contingent upon the nature of the power systems and the capacity of the power systems. So I think power generation is key today in development of agricultural production. And agricultural production is essential because of the massive drought, soil erosion, and other problems associated with the agricultural development in Africa. Also with the war in Ukraine, there's been a problem with supply chains as it relates to not only agricultural products, but also inputs such as fertilizer and machinery that is needed. So in regard to developing import substitution industries, power generation would be essential in that process.
For the time being, the only reliable options for many African countries is to look east, Russia in particular, if they want to get nuclear power. But that option could be challenging. Iran's cooperation with Russia in that regard is a case in hand.
Although Tehran has cooperation with Moscow in terms of peaceful nuclear energy, the Iranian experts have managed to indigenously develop the cycle for uranium enrichment. Now, what can African countries learn from Iran, especially in relying on indigenous expertise to build and maintain their peaceful nuclear programs?
The African Union member states have a tremendous amount to learn from Iran. After 43 years of an independent existence during the revolution after 1979, Iran has made tremendous strides in regard to its own national development. And it has done it largely through a program of self-reliance. And I think that the Iranian government and its use of nuclear technology for peaceful purposes can be instructive for other countries around the world. This is despite, you know, the slander and the allegations made by the United States that Iran is utilizing its nuclear capability for military purposes, yet successive Iranian governments have rejected this allegation. And I think this is something that African states and other developing countries can learn from.
Well, I'd like to thank our guest, Abayomi Ezekiwe, for his incisive analysis. And we now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the decision by the Nigerian government to use local languages and not English in primary schools. Stay with us.
Nigeria promoting local languages.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Let me start this part by asking you a question. Now, how many local languages do you think are there in Nigeria? Well, the answer is 625. That's lots of local languages, isn't it? Now, the Nigerian government has approved a new national language policy that will mandate the use of local languages as a language of instruction for primary school pupils instead of English.
Nigeria now has a national language policy. The policy document is here, and if I will have to tell you one highlight is in it, there is government has agreed now instruction in primary school, the first 6 years will be in the mother tongue. In principle, it has been agreed, but I know implementing it will require a lot of work to develop the material, to teach and get the teachers and so on. But the policy has been approved. Mother tongue is mother tongue. There are 625 languages in Nigeria. If we had the material, let's say instructional material and teachers, this will be used to teach. The community will teach children in its own language. It's not restricted to the three languages that were promoted, Hausa, Igbo, Yoruba. Mother tongue is mother tongue. So when the policy is fully operational, each locality will teach students in primary one, up to six in their own mother tongue.
Now, to discuss this, we are joined by Inem Richardson. She's the co-founder of the Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. She's also an organizer with All African People's Revolutionary Party. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be back on.
Now, do you think Nigeria has made the right decision in promoting the use of local languages in lower primary schools instead of English?
Personally, I think this is a positive development coming out of Nigeria. I think that for a long time, unfortunately, since the colonial period, there has been some level of neglect towards African languages, which at one point were languages of literature and science, and to some extent have fallen by the wayside as Africa adopted colonial languages as the official languages of the various countries of the continent. So I believe that this is a positive development both in terms of African dignity and self-esteem, but also for basic educational reasons. You know, these are the languages that students, children are speaking at home. So it's going to benefit their own educational experience to be educated in a language that they're already familiar with and can now advance in.
English is Nigeria's official language. It is also the language of instruction in all levels of education. Using the local languages in primary schools does not mean that English would be put aside altogether. Authorities say that English and mother tongue will be combined from the start of junior secondary school. The Nigerian Education Minister said the decision is only in principle for now, because it will require a lot of work to implement it. Critics say most Nigerian indigenous languages lack scientific precision or terminological exactitude, as legions of scientific terms do not have corresponding terms. How can this challenge be tackled?
Well, I think we need to understand that, you know, there are no superior or inferior languages in the world. All languages are dynamic. All languages evolve. And all languages are designed to develop, to reflect the conditions and reality of the people. So at one point, the languages of Nigeria were very apt in terms of and very adequate to match with the reality of life in Nigeria. But because English was prioritized, unfortunately, sometimes the indigenous languages of Nigeria were sort of pushed to the wayside in terms of developing on a scientific level. But that's not at all impossible.
This is not the first time that African local languages are promoted to take the place of English, but have the past experiences been successful, and do you have any case to point?
We've seen certain developments with other African languages in other countries. One example is Sheikh Anta Diop, who was a Pan-Africanist and scholar from Senegal, famously gave an advanced mathematics class in Wolof. And people who took the class remarked that it was the first time that they'd ever heard somebody use certain mathematical terms like tangent and exponent in the Wolof language. It is totally possible to develop African languages in this to match with the current scientific standards, to match with the current literary standards. It's actually a natural process, so I don't think that should be a major concern.
Nigeria's Minister of Education says so much has been lost owing to the extinction of some local languages. He underlines that the government is determined to preserve cultures. He notes that all Nigerian languages are equal and will be treated as such.
Some experts argue that using an indigenous language is a remedy to make the diversity effect turn positive and become significantly correlated with the economic growth and industrial development. Is the use of indigenous languages in schools and universities critical in Africa's industrialization?
Absolutely. I don't think that Africa really has a true long-term pathway towards development based on the colonial languages that we currently speak across the continent. I think sometimes we underestimate to what extent these colonial languages sort of tie us to a specific camp or a specific colonial power.
Back in November, French President Emmanuel Macron claimed that French is the true African language that can help African countries reach unity. Now, the comments have enraged many who view Macron's comments as remnants of the colonial era when France and other colonial powers forcibly imposed their languages as civilized language. Now, what's your take on Macron's comments?
Recently, Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, came under some level of heat when he publicly proclaimed that French is the language of Pan-Africanism. Many people sort of ridiculed that statement. In some way, actually, I would say that maybe the joke is on us here on the continent because we haven't sufficiently developed our own indigenous languages and, you know, officialized our indigenous languages and put them up to standards so that they can become world languages, major languages of communication.
Well, some critics have insisted that it is more practical to continue using colonial languages as the medium of instruction in African schools. Now, these languages tend to be more widely spoken worldwide and could, as such, be considered more useful in the long run. Do you agree with this perception?
The way that we are currently functioning is that we are very much tied to specific linguistic spheres in which we occupy these sort of positions in a marginal position, like around this orbit that is Europe, which is the center of these languages. So it really does put us in a more dependent position culturally, but I also believe that this has a direct economic implication. So African sovereignty does require linguistic sovereignty as well.
The African Union, which is made up of 55 member states, has officially adopted Swahili, an indigenous African language, as an official working language. Should African countries adopt this as the lingua franca in schools to promote continental cohesion in the education sector?
European languages are still dominant throughout the continent, and it will take a big effort to shift that. Currently, English is the official or the second language in 27 out of 55 countries in Africa, and French is the official language in 21 of them. So, do you think Swahili can really pull off to replace one of these languages?
Proponents of Swahili are not saying that we need to get rid of Igbo or Wolof or Zulu. We're saying that we can replace the colonial languages with Swahili and still promote all of the various indigenous languages of Africa. And of course, we should speak the world languages as well. We should have people that speak Chinese and French and English, just like every other part of the world that is important to exist in within an international economy, you know, for diplomatic relations, that's important. But Africa does need a means of communicating across these various, these countries and these regions. And Swahili could really be that glue that replaces French, English, Portuguese, Spanish with something that is a little closer to home and is also something that other countries, other parts of the continent have already developed to a certain extent, such as Tanzania, thanks to great Pan-African leaders like Julius Nyerere.
Well, that's it indeed. African countries can pull off to have their own lingua franca. And if a language is to bring unity to the continent, that language must be from the continent itself. That brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, from the day the human being, because of the modern technology, was able in order to record the videos or the audios, no more miracles or miracle-like actions were recorded. What is the main reason? For example, once in a history, we can say the stick of Moses was changed into a dragon, or the sea was split, or the dead body was alive. The blind one was healed by Jesus Christ, and so many other examples of the miracles of the Prophet. Why not taking place now?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It seems that those people who have, tried to spread this, doubt and misconception, are somehow trying to say that these miracles are just fake stories, mm-hmm. and none of them has ever happened, because from the time that people were able to record the events, now we do not see the miracles anymore. So the conclusion is that all these stories are nothing but lies. But the point is that, first of all, according to this question, as you mentioned, they claim that from the time that people were able to record, through technologies, there is no miracle anymore. But the point is that, the last prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, he lived in the 7th century, AD, and according to the historical reports, he passed away in 633 AD. But all these new technologies, like the means for taking photos and videos, they were invented and discovered in the 19th century after Hijra. So we have a gap of about 12 centuries, which means that this is not a true claim that from the time that people were able to record, there is no miracle anymore. No. The miracles stopped 12 centuries before that. Mm-hmm. So which means that if the prophets wanted, followers of the prophet wanted to continue telling lies and fake stories, they could have continued that for another 12 centuries. Because there is a gap of 12 centuries between the prophet and these new technologies. But there is no miracle mentioned in this time.
So the concept of miracle or mu'jaza is, finished with the last prophet, that is Khatam al-Anbiya, Prophet Muhammad, so, which is the Holy Quran.
No, my point is that it has nothing to do with new technologies, because the one who want to somehow raise this doubt, they want to mention that, they were able to spread these lies because no one was able to, take photos and, make videos. But the point is that if this is the case, but then why it stopped 12 centuries before these new technologies?
Yes.
They could have continued to do so.
And we know that mu'jaza and miracle is only limited to prophets and nobody. Even the a'immas of the Shias, show karama, which is very much different from miracle. Or we can say mu'jaza.
Answering your question, there are two main elements for mu'jaza. Mm-hmm. That is, first of all, it is a supernatural action, which means that it is against the laws that we are familiar with, but it is not against the law of, for example, the principle of cause and effect, no. But it is supernatural.
Yes.
And second of all, it is accompanied by the claim of prophethood.
Okay.
So a person who brings a mu'jiza, he claims that he is a prophet. Mm-hmm. Then second of all, he brings a supernatural action. Mm-hmm. And third, it cannot be imitated by any other
person.
And
it has mass witnesses.
Yeah.
It is a collective witnesses with the presence of the people.
Exactly.
For example, hiddenly, we do not have any mu'jiza in the history of prophets, which was done hiddenly and secretly. No, it was not. That's it was point. Known to all.
Definitely.
Okay. Yes.
But what is the difference between mu'jiza and karama? Mm-hmm. The only difference is that the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt also performed some, also call it miracle, but not, technically mu'jiza. The only difference is that the karama is a supernatural action done by the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, Harim Salam, but not with the claim of prophethood, because there is no prophethood after Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. So what is done by the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, Harim Salam, are also supernatural.
Yes.
They want to prove their imamate.
Yes.
But the only difference with mu'jiza is that they are not claiming prophethood mm-hmm. anymore. But the nature of the action is the same. It yes. is against the law that people are familiar with.
Yes.
And they are well acquainted with.
Okay.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Insha'Allah, insha'Allah,
insha'Allah, you'll find your way. We know that usually the miracle done by the Prophet was in line with the conditions and situations of the people at their time. So, for example, at the time of Prophet Moses, alayhi salam, some people were expert in magic.
Yes.
And that is why what is done by Prophet Moses, alayhi salam, is not a magic, but somehow it is similar to magic. I mean, some people consider it magic, although it was not magic. So that to show to the people that, it's a kind of miracle. And we know that the most expert magicians of the time, which were asked by Pharaoh to come,
yes.
they witnessed that this is not magic anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not magic,
yes.
what is done by Moses. And that is why all of them believed in Moses, alayhi salam.
For example, when the ocean was split in two halves.
That's the point.
That was not a magic, okay.
What is done by Jesus, alayhi salam, mm-hmm. Some of his miracles is about healing the people.
Yes.
Because at that time, we have some, physicians
yes.
who were famous for healing the people. And now Jesus comes to bring, to do some actions, which is not, done by anyone at that time.
Yes.
Like healing the lepers, for example.
Yes.
Or reviving a dead, which
yes.
is not possible. It was not possible at
healing
that
time. Healing the blind one.
Exactly.
Yes.
And now, when it comes to our Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, the point is that people at that time are famous for their abilities in poetry and rhetorics, and now the Holy Prophet is bringing a miracle in the form of a book. Why? First, because of the fact that he is the last prophet, which means that he's, as you rightly mentioned, people should witness the miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And if the Holy Prophet wanted to show any other miracle, it was only witnessed by the people of his time.
Mm-hmm.
But now he's bringing a book which can be read by all the people till the Day of Judgment. So the miracle of the last prophet is in the form of a book so that all the people can study it and read it and come to this conclusion that it is a miracle done
yes.
by the Prophet, peace be upon him,
that's right.
and his family.
Okay.
Of course, it doesn't mean that the Holy Prophet did not perform other miracles. No, mm-hmm. there are other miracles attributed to him, but this is the main miracle of the Prophet.
And we know that during the history, the Holy Quran for the Muslims have been considered as a miracle, a mu'jiza. And the Holy Quran itself invites the people, if you can bring one ayah the same as that, it shows that it is sure about being a miracle. So the people cannot bring a miracle like that, isn't it?
Just let me correct what you mentioned.
Okay.
The challenges of the Quran are in three stages.
Mm-hmm.
To bring a book like the Quran, to bring 10 chapters
yes.
like the Quran, and to bring one chapter.
Yes.
We do not have any verse to say that to bring one verse.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Of course, many people, they